Chapter 2. The Revision and Reenchantment of Psychology. Legacy from a Half Century of Consciousness Research. Part 1.
The history of psychonautics, explored at the beginning of this book, examined the pivotal role that holotropic states of consciousness played in the spiritual, ritual, and cultural life of ancient societies and aboriginal cultures. We also review the detrimental effect that the periods of the Industrial and Scientific Revolution and the ages of enlightenment and reason had on the image, status, and cultivation of these states. This year, we are celebrating the 75th anniversary of Albert Hofmann's discovery of the psychedelic effects of LSD-25, an event that became a critical turning point in the history of psychonautics. The initial excitement engendered by the consciousness revolution that LSD and other psychedelics brought into modern society was unfortunately short-lived. Irrational legal and administrative sanctions effectively terminated all scientific research and drove the experimentation with psychedelics underground. Albert Hofmann's vision of a new Eleusis, a society that would succeed in integrating the responsible use of psychedelic medicines into mainstream life for the benefit of all humanity, seemed like a sad pipe dream. After a dark era of psychonautics that lasted several decades, we are currently experiencing a global renaissance of interest in the scientific research of psychedelic medicines, as well as lay's self-experimentation with them. One way of looking at this renaissance is to see it as rectifying the errors of ignorant legislators and correcting the course of the evolution of psychiatry. From another perspective, though, it means rejoining the rest of humanity in appreciating and using the extraordinary potential of holotropic states. Our industrial civilization has so far been the only group in human history that has not recognized and utilized their value. This surprising development inspired me to write this encyclopedia for Inner Journeys, so that the information about consciousness and the human psyche that I have amassed during 60 years of research is available for the new generation of researchers and for future psychonauts. I believe this information is essential for maximizing the positive potential of these states and minimizing their risks. Discovering Holotropic States, A Journey Down Memory Lane. My own interest in consciousness research began in the fourth year of my medical studies when I began spending my free time working as a student volunteer at the psychiatric clinic of the medical faculty in Prague. I was fascinated by the lectures of Professor Vladimir Vondracek, a brilliant, charismatic man with a physical resemblance to George Bernard Shaw or Moulin Rouge's Valentin le Désossé. Professor Vondracek's special interest was to find and present the cases of psychiatric patients whose personalities and clinical symptoms resembled those of famous historical figures, particularly saints, prophets, and founders of religions. It was not until 20 years later, when my wife Christina and I developed the concept of spiritual emergency, that I became critical of Professor Vondracek's book, The Fantastical and Magical, from the point of view of psychiatry. Another book of his, however, became important for my professional development. It was his classic Pharmacology of the Soul that brought a group of psychoactive substances that later became known as psychedelics to the attention of Czech psychiatrists. At the time, there was another source of information related to psychedelics available in Czech literature, the essays by psychiatrist and pharmacologist Svetozar Nevole. Apropos of four-dimensional vision, study of physiopathology of the spatial sense with special regard to experimental intoxication with mescaline, and apropos of sensory illusions and their formal genesis. I was thus already familiar with and interested in psychedelics before LSD came into my life. After Albert Hofmann's discovery of LSD's psychedelic effects and the publication of Werner Stoll's pilot study, the Sandoz Pharmaceutical Company was sending free samples of LSD to universities, psychiatric institutes, and individual researchers and therapists all over the world. My preceptor at the psychiatric clinic, Dr. George Rubischek, was one of the people who received a large package of 25 microgram dragées and a big box of 100 microgram ampules of LSD-25 with the trade name Delicid. The letter accompanying the package described Albert Hofmann's discovery of the psychedelic effects of LSD and the results of Werner Stoll's pilot study. It asked the recipients if they would be interested in conducting research with this substance and to give Sandoz feedback about its effects, as well as its potential use in psychiatry and psychology. Dr. Stoll's paper pointed out some interesting similarities between the LSD experience and the symptomatology of naturally occurring psychoses. It seemed plausible that the study of such experimental psychoses could provide interesting insights into the causes of naturally occurring psychotic states, particularly schizophrenia, the most enigmatic of psychiatric disorders. Werner Stoll also suggested that LSD should be tested as a possible therapeutic agent. The letter from Sandoz also contained a little note that became my destiny and profoundly changed my personal and professional life. It suggested that this substance might be used as a revolutionary, unconventional educational tool for mental health professionals working with psychotic patients. The possibility of experiencing irreversible experimental psychosis seemed to provide a unique opportunity for psychiatrists, psychologists, psychiatric nurses, social workers, and students of psychiatry to gain intimate personal knowledge of the inner world of their clients. It would make it possible to understand them better, be able to communicate with them more effectively, and as a result, treat them more successfully. New therapeutic strategies were sorely needed at a time when the treatments were truly medieval. Insulin comas, electroconvulsive therapy, cardiazol shocks, and prefrontal lobotomy. I was at that point becoming disillusioned by psychoanalysis, realizing the amount of time and money it required and how unimpressive the results were. I was extremely excited about such an extraordinary training opportunity and asked Dr. Rubischek if I could have an LSD session. Unfortunately, the staff of the psychiatric clinic decided that, for a variety of reasons, students would not be accepted as volunteers. Dr. Rubischek was very interested in the new substance, but too busy to spend hours at a time in the LSD sessions of his experimental subjects. He needed help, and there were no objections against me supervising the psychedelic sessions of others and keeping records of their experiences. I thus had sat in the LSD sessions of many Czech psychiatrists and psychologists, prominent artists, and other interested persons before I myself qualified as an experimental subject. By the time I graduated from the medical school and was myself eligible for a session, my appetite had been repeatedly whetted by fantastic accounts of the experiences of others that I had witnessed. In the fall of 1956, after my graduation from the medical school, I was finally able to have my own LSD session. Dr. Rubischek's area of special interest was research of the electrical activity of the brain. One of the conditions for participating in the LSD study was to agree to have an EEG recording taken before during and after the session. In addition, at the time of my session, he was particularly fascinated by what was called driving, or entraining the brainwaves. This involved exposure to various frequencies of a strong, flashing, stroboscopic light and finding out to what extent the brainwaves in the suboccipital area of the brain, the optical cortex, could be entrained, that is, forced to pick up the incoming frequency. Eager to have the LSD experience, I readily agreed to have my EEG taken and my brain waves driven. My brother Paul, who was at that time a medical student and was also deeply interested in psychiatry, agreed to supervise my session. I started feeling the effects of LSD about 45 minutes after the ingestion. At first, there was a feeling of slight malaise, lightheadedness, and nausea. Then these symptoms disappeared and were replaced by a fantastic display of incredibly colorful abstract and geometrical visions unfolding in rapid kaleidoscopic sequences. Some of them resembled exquisite stained glass windows in medieval Gothic cathedrals, others arabesques from Muslim mosques. To describe the exquisite nature of these visions, I made references to Scheherazade and 1001 Nights, and to the stunning beauty of Alhambra and Samuel Taylor Coleridge's fantastic description of Kublai Khan's legendary Xanadu. At the time, these were the only associations I was able to make. Today, I believe that my psyche somehow managed to produce a wild array of fractal images, similar to the graphic representations of nonlinear equations that can be created by modern computers. As the session continued, my experience moved through and beyond this realm of exquisite aesthetic rapture and changed into an encounter and confrontation with my unconscious psyche. It is difficult to find words for the intoxicating fugue of emotions, visions, and illuminating insights into my life and existence in general that became available to me on this level of my psyche. It was so profound and shattering that it instantly overshadowed my previous interest in Freudian psychoanalysis. I could not believe how much I learned in those few hours. The breathtaking aesthetic feast and the rich plethora of psychological insights would have been sufficient in and of themselves to make my first encounter with LSD a truly memorable experience. However, all that paled in comparison with what was yet to come. Between the third and fourth hour of my session, when the effect of the LSD was culminating, Dr. Rubicek's research assistant appeared and announced that it was time for the EEG experiment. She took me to a small room, carefully pasted electrodes on my scalp, and asked me to lie down and close my eyes. She then placed a giant stroboscopic light above my head and turned it on. The effects of the LSD immensely amplified the impact of the strobe, and I was hit by a vision of light of incredible radiance and supernatural beauty. It made me think of the accounts of mystical experiences I had read about in spiritual literatures, in which the visions of divine light were compared with the incandescence of millions of suns. It crossed my mind that this was what it must have been like at the epicenter of the atomic explosions in Hiroshima or Nagasaki. Today, I think it was more like Dharmakaya, or the primary clear light, the luminosity of indescribable brilliance that, according to the Tibetan Book of the Dead, Bardo Todol, appears to us at the moment of our death. I felt that a divine thunderbolt had catapulted my conscious self out of my body. I lost my awareness of the research assistant, the laboratory, the psychiatric clinic, Prague, and then the planet. My consciousness expanded at an inconceivable speed and reached cosmic dimensions. I lost the connection with my everyday identity. There were no more boundaries or difference between me and the universe. I felt that my old personality was extinguished and that I ceased to exist. And I felt that by becoming nothing, I became everything. The research assistant carefully followed her protocol for the experiment. She gradually shifted the frequency of the strobe from 2 to 60 hertz, frequencies per second, and back again, and then put it for a short time to the middle of the alpha band, theta band, and finally the delta band. While this was happening, I found myself at the center of a cosmic drama of unimaginable dimensions. In the astronomical literature that I read over the following years, I found names for some of the phenomena that seemed like what I had experienced during these extraordinary 10 minutes. The Big Bang, passage through black holes, white holes, and wormholes, as well as exploding supernovas and collapsing stars. Although I had no adequate words for what had happened to me, there was no doubt in my mind that my experience was very close to those I knew from the great mystical scriptures of the world. Even though my psyche was deeply affected by the effects of LSD, I was able to see the irony and paradox of the situation. The divine manifested and took me over in the middle of a serious scientific experiment involving a substance produced in the test tube of a 20th century Swiss chemist and conducted in a psychiatric clinic in a country that was dominated by the Soviet Union and had a communist regime. I could see how experiences of this kind would make people lose interest in bloody revolution and become the opium of the masses. This day marked the beginning of my radical departure from traditional thinking in psychiatry and from the monistic materialism of Western science. I emerged from this experience touched to the core and immensely impressed by its power, not believing at that time, as I do today, that the potential for a mystical experience is the natural birthright of all human beings. I attributed everything that happened to the combined effect of LSD and the stroboscopic light. But I felt strongly that the study of non-ordinary states of consciousness in general, and those induced by psychedelics in particular, was by far the most interesting area of psychiatry I could imagine. I realized that, under the proper circumstances, psychedelic experiences could become a royal road into the unconscious, to a much greater degree than dreams were for Freud. And right there and then, I decided to dedicate my life to the study of non-ordinary states of consciousness. For the rest of my life, this research has been my profession, vocation, and passion. The Emperor's New Clothes. Struggle with the dominant paradigm. The 6 decades that I have dedicated to consciousness research have been an extraordinary adventure of discovery and self-discovery. I spent the first 2 of them conducting psychotherapy with psychedelic substances, initially as principal investigator at the Psychiatric Research Institute in Prague, Czechoslovakia, and then at the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center in Baltimore, Maryland, where I participated in the last surviving official American psychedelic research program. Beginning in 1975, my wife Christina and I worked with holotropic breathwork, a powerful method of therapy and self-exploration that we jointly developed at the Esalen Institute in Big Sur, California. Over the years, we also supported many people undergoing spontaneous episodes of holotropic states of consciousness, psycho-spiritual crises, or spiritual emergencies, as we called them. In psychedelic therapy, holotropic states are brought about by administering consciousness-expanding substances, such as LSD, psilocybin, mescaline, and tryptamine, or amphetamine derivatives. In holotropic breathwork, consciousness is changed by a combination of faster breathing, evocative music, and energy-releasing bodywork. In spiritual emergencies, holotropic states occur spontaneously in the middle of everyday life, and their cause is usually unknown. If they are correctly understood and supported, these episodes have an extraordinary healing, transformative, heuristic, and even evolutionary potential. I have also been tangentially involved in many disciplines that are more or less directly related to holotropic states of consciousness. I have spent a lot of time exchanging information with anthropologists and have participated in sacred ceremonies of native cultures in different parts of the world, with and without the ingestion of psychedelic plants, such as peyote, ayahuasca, psilocybe mushrooms, and kava kava. This involved contact with various North American, Mexican, South American, African, and Ainu shamans and healers. I have also had extensive contact with representatives of various spiritual disciplines, including Vipassana, Zen, and Vajrayana Buddhism, Siddha Yoga, Tantra, and the Christian Benedictine Order. In addition, I have closely followed the development of thanatology, the young discipline studying near-death experiences, and the psychological and spiritual aspects of death and dying. In the late 1960s and early 1970s, I participated in a large research project studying the effects of psychedelic therapy for individuals dying of cancer. I have also been privileged to personally know some of the great psychics and parapsychologists of our era, pioneers of laboratory consciousness research, and therapists who had developed and practiced powerful forms of experiential therapy that induce holotropic states of consciousness. Some of my clients and trainees have experienced UFO and alien abduction phenomena, so I closely followed the work of John Mack, Harvard psychoanalyst and dear friend of mine, who conducted a large, controversial, and widely publicized study of the alien abduction syndrome. My initial encounter with holotropic states was very difficult and challenging, both intellectually and emotionally. In the early years of my laboratory and clinical psychedelic research, I was bombarded daily with experiences and observations for which my medical and psychiatric training had not prepared me. As a matter of fact, I was experiencing and observing things that were considered impossible in the context of the scientific worldview I had obtained during my medical training. And yet, those supposedly impossible things were happening all the time. I have described these anomalous phenomena before in my articles and books. It took me years of daily participation in sessions with my patients and dozens of my own sessions before I was able to finally overcome the last remnants of the awe and respect that medical students and novice psychiatrists have for university professors and other scientific authorities. The influx of revolutionary data was inexorable. I eventually came to a firm conviction that the proud edifice of traditional psychiatry, with its mechanistic, materialistic philosophy, is a giant on clay legs that stands in the way of genuine understanding of the human psyche and has a damaging effect on many people diagnosed as mentally ill. So I decided to dedicate my life and work to a concerted effort aimed at changing the dominant paradigm. Holotropic states of consciousness and psychiatry. Psychedelic research and the development of experiential therapeutic techniques in the second half of the 20th century moved holotropic states of consciousness from the world of healers of ancient and native cultures into modern psychiatry and psychotherapy. Therapists who were open to these new approaches and used them in their practice or their own self-exploration, like myself, were able to confirm the extraordinary healing potential of holotropic states. We discovered their value as gold mines of revolutionary new information about consciousness, the human psyche, and the nature of reality. I have described these paradigm-breaking observations in a series of books published between the mid-1970s and the end of the 1990s. In the late 1990s, I received a phone call from Jane Bunker, my editor at State University of New York, SUNY Press, who had published several of my books exploring different aspects of my work. She asked me if I could consider writing a book in one volume that would summarize the observations from my research and would also serve as an introduction to my earlier books. She also asked if I could specifically focus on the experiences and observations from my research that current scientific theories are not able to explain, and suggest the revisions in our thinking that would be necessary to account for these revolutionary findings. After some hesitation, she added an even more challenging request. She asked me if I could try sketching what psychiatry and psychology would look like if we integrate all these paradigm-breaking observations. This was a tall order, but also a great opportunity. My 70th birthday was rapidly approaching, and a new generation of facilitators was conducting our holotropic breathwork training all over the world. We needed a manual covering the material that was taught in our training modules, and here was an unexpected opportunity to publish a guidebook that would bring homogeneity into our training. I decided to write the book Jane had asked for and gave it a deliberately provocative title, Psychology of the Future. I realized that if I gave it a name like my previous books, Beyond the Brain, The Holotropic Mind, or The Stormy Search for the Self, it might get lukewarm attention from potential readers. A title proposing what psychology should look like in the future seemed to be more eye-catching and engaging. Potential readers would get either interested in what I might be offering or challenged and irritated by such a presumptuous title. By the time I wrote the book, though, I was convinced that my conclusions were correct and that they would be confirmed in the future research of holotropic states, however long that might take. The new psychology that I outlined in the book Psychology of the Future is absolutely necessary and indispensable if we want to start practicing psychonautics or understand any problem or issues related to holotropic states of consciousness. In various chapters of this encyclopedia, I draw on the observations and experiences from the research of these states, so I will first outline, as a general frame of reference, the basic features of this new psychology. I will describe the radical changes in our thinking about the human psyche in health and disease, about consciousness, and even about the nature of reality that it requires. Modern consciousness research and the dawning of a new paradigm. I would like to set the discussion about the necessary revision of thinking in psychiatry and psychology into a larger historical context. In 1962, Thomas Kuhn, one of the most influential philosophers of the 20th century, published his groundbreaking book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. On the basis of 15 years of intensive study on the history of science, he demonstrated that the development of knowledge about the universe in various scientific disciplines is not a process of gradual accumulation of data and the formulation of ever more accurate theories, as is usually assumed. Instead, it shows a clearly cyclical nature with specific stages and characteristic dynamics which can even be predicted. The central concept of Kuhn's theory which makes this possible is that of a paradigm. A paradigm can be defined as a constellation of basic metaphysical assumptions, beliefs, values, and techniques shared by the members of the community at a particular historical period. It also determines what are legitimate areas and topics for scientific research, and how to conduct it and evaluate it. During the period when a dominant paradigm guides the thinking and activity of the academic community, scientists are doing what Kuhn calls normal science, which is essentially problem-solving within a set of established rules, similar to playing chess. A dominant paradigm maintains its governing influence on scientists until some of its basic assumptions are seriously challenged by new observations. Initially, the scientific community dismisses the inconvenient findings as products of bad science, attributing them to lack of experience, mental derangement, or dishonesty of the individuals responsible for them. When the observations withstand the test of time and are independently confirmed or supported by other scientists, it results in the period of abnormal science. In this critical period of conceptual crisis and confusion, it becomes permissible to propose radically new ways of viewing and interpreting the phenomena that the old paradigm is unable to explain. Eventually, one of these alternatives satisfies the necessary requirements to become the new paradigm that then dominates the thinking in the next period of the history of science. At this time, the history of science is rewritten, and new individuals become the heroes of science, geniuses who centuries ago had ideas that are now an important part of the new paradigm. Thus, Democritus and Leucippus, Greek philosophers of the 5th century BC, wrote about atoms, or tiny indivisible particles, as the basic constituents of the material world. Fritjof Capra showed in his book, The Tao of Physics, that the understanding of matter in quantum relativistic physics had been anticipated millennia ago by ancient Indian sages. The relationship between the part and the whole, revealed by optical holography, was an integral part of the concept of jiva in ancient Jain scriptures, of the teaching about mutual interpenetration found in the 7th and 8th centuries AD in Avatamsaka, Huayan, Buddhism, and of the book Monadology by the 17th century German philosopher Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz. The most famous historical examples of paradigm shifts are the replacement of the Ptolemaic geocentric system by the heliocentric system of Nicholas Copernicus, Galileo Galilei, and Johannes Kepler, the overthrow of Johann Joachim Becher's phlogiston theory in chemistry by Antoine Lavoisier's and John Dalton's atomic theory, and the conceptual cataclysms in physics in the first three decades of the 20th century that undermined the hegemony of Newtonian physics and gave birth to Einstein's theories of relativity and quantum physics. The paradigm shifts usually come as a major surprise to the mainstream academic community, because its members tend to see the leading paradigm as an accurate and definitive description of reality, rather than the best possible organization of the information available at that time. Alfred Korzybski and Gregory Bateson called this error in thinking confusing the map with the territory. Bateson, known for his wry British humor, illustrated this fallacy with a parallel from everyday life. If a scientist thinks in this way, he might one day go to the restaurant and eat the menu instead of his dinner. A good example of this mistake is the address that Lord Kelvin gave in 1900. Only decades before the advent of quantum relativistic physics, to an assembly of physicists at the British Association for the Advancement of Science, he declared, There is nothing new to be discovered in physics now. All that remains is more and more precise measurements. In the last 6 decades, various avenues of modern consciousness research have revealed a rich array of anomalous phenomena, experiences and observations that have undermined some of the generally accepted assertions of modern psychiatry, psychology, and psychotherapy concerning the nature and dimensions of the human psyche, the origins of emotional and psychosomatic disorders, and effective therapeutic mechanisms. These anomalous phenomena came from field anthropology, thanatology, parapsychology, psychedelic research, and powerful experiential therapies. Many of these observations are so radical that they question the basic metaphysical assumptions of materialistic science concerning the nature of reality and of human beings, as well as the relationship between consciousness and matter. Psychology of the Future: Lessons from Modern Consciousness Research. During the last 6 decades, I have conducted psychedelic therapy with LSD, psilocybin, dipropyltryptamine, DPT, and methylene dioxyamphetamine, MDA, facilitated sessions with holotropic breathwork, and worked with people experiencing spiritual emergencies. In these sessions, I have observed and experienced countless paradigm-breaking phenomena, indicating an urgent need for a radical revision of the most fundamental assumptions of mainstream psychiatry, psychology, and psychotherapy. I have identified 7 areas which require substantial and far-reaching changes in our understanding of consciousness and the human psyche in health and disease. 1. The nature of consciousness and its relationship to matter. 2. New cartography of the human psyche, as above, so below. 3. Architecture of emotional and psychosomatic disorders. 4. Effective therapeutic mechanisms. 5. Strategy of psychotherapy and self-exploration. 6. The role of spirituality in human life. 7. The importance of archetypal astrology for psychology. Unless we change our thinking in these areas, our understanding of psychogenic, emotional, and psychosomatic disorders will remain superficial, unsatisfactory, and incomplete, and their therapy ineffective and disappointing. Psychiatry and psychology will be unable to genuinely comprehend the nature and origin of spirituality, and appreciate the important role that it plays in the human psyche, human history, and in the universal scheme of things. These revisions are therefore essential for understanding the ritual, spiritual, and religious history of humanity. Shamanism, rites of passage, the ancient mysteries of death and rebirth, and the great religions of the world. Without these radical changes in our thinking, potentially healing, transformative, and heuristically invaluable spontaneous holotropic experiences, spiritual emergencies, will be misdiagnosed as psychotic and treated by suppressive medication. A large array of the experiences and observations from the research of holotropic states will remain mystifying, anomalous phenomena, events that, according to the current scientific paradigms, should not be possible. A good definition of anomalous phenomena is what is left when you apply a bad theory. An avalanche of anomalous phenomena in modern consciousness research indicates an urgent need for a radical paradigm shift. Without this revision, mental health professionals will also have difficulty accepting the therapeutic power of psychedelic substances, because it is mediated by profound experiences that are currently seen as psychotic. This can be demonstrated by looking at the terms that mainstream clinicians and academicians use to describe psychedelics: experimental psychoses, hallucinogens, psychotomimetics, and even delirogens. This view reflects their inability to recognize the true nature of holotropic experiences as germane expressions of the deep dynamics of the psyche. Even I have felt a strong resistance to the bewildering experiences and observations from the research of holotropic states, as well as the phenomena associated with them, such as astonishing synchronicities. It is not surprising, therefore, that the changes I am proposing have not been enthusiastically embraced by the academic community during the past 50 years since I started talking about them. I found them very challenging intellectually, in spite of the fact that I was personally present in a large number of sessions and had the opportunity to experience them in my own sessions. This is understandable, considering the scope and radical nature of the necessary conceptual revisions. We are not talking about a minor patchwork, known as ad hoc hypotheses, but a major fundamental overhaul. The resulting conceptual cataclysm would be comparable in its nature and scope to the revolution that physicists had to face in the first 3 decades of the 20th century, when they were forced to move from Newtonian physics to Einstein's theories of relativity, and then to quantum physics. In fact, the conceptual changes I am proposing in the understanding of consciousness and the human psyche would represent a logical complement to the radical changes in our understanding of matter that have already occurred in physics. I have found that my friends and acquaintances who are quantum relativistic physicists are much more open to these new ideas than mainstream psychiatrists and psychologists. Physicists are rapidly becoming avant-garde in the research of consciousness, leaving psychiatrists far behind. The history of science abounds with examples of individuals who dared to challenge the dominant paradigm. Typically, their ideas were initially dismissed as products of ignorance, poor judgment, bad science, fraud, or even insanity. I can actually give a good personal example of the nature and intensity of the emotional exchanges during this period of abnormal science. In Prague, on October 5, 2007, I received the Vision 97 Award from the foundation of Václav Havel and his wife Dagmar, former recipients of this prestigious award, which was given every year on the birthday of the Czech president Havel to a selected laureate, include American neurosurgeon and thinker Carl Prebram, former U.S. Secretary of Labor Robert Reich, Philip G. Zimbardo, the Stanford psychologist known for his 1971 prison experiment, MIT professor of computer science and pioneer in artificial intelligence Joseph Weizenbaum, and semiotician and writer Umberto Eco. 7 years earlier, in the year 2000, I received a mock award called the Delusional Boulder from the Prague Sisyphus Club. This club is a group of scientistic Czech academicians and self-appointed arbiters of the purity of science, similar to Carl Sagan's American CSICOP group. This organization, like its American model, was headed by an astronomer, Dr. Jiri Grigar. Their annual award is intended to express the club members' ridicule of silly individuals who have spent years of hard labor, like Sisyphus, and produced something utterly futile and absurd that makes no sense to rational thinkers. In 2008, after I had received the Vision 97 Award, the enraged board members of the Sisyphus Club declared that my ideas were so outrageous and ridiculous that they had decided to create for me a special category, the Diamond Arch Delusional Boulder. Interested readers can read this entire history, with photos on my personal website, stanislavgrof.com, in the section CV/bio. I am now in the 9th decade of my life, a time when researchers often try to review their professional career and summarize the conclusions they have reached. More than half a century of research into holotropic states, my own, as well as that of many of my transpersonally oriented colleagues, has amassed so much supportive evidence for a radically new understanding of consciousness and of the human psyche that I have decided to describe this new vision in its full form without trying to soften its controversial nature in any way. The fact that the new findings challenge the most fundamental metaphysical assumptions of materialistic science should not be a sufficient reason for rejecting them. Whether this new vision will ultimately be refuted or accepted by the academic community should be determined by the unbiased future research of holotropic states of consciousness. The nature of consciousness and its relationship to matter. According to the current scientific worldview, consciousness is an epiphenomenon of material processes. It allegedly emerges out of the complexity of the neurophysiological processes in the brain. This thesis is presented with great authority, as if it had been scientifically proven beyond any reasonable doubt. On closer inspection, though, we discover that it is a basic metaphysical assumption of monistic materialistic science that is not supported by facts and actually contradicts the findings of modern consciousness research. Very few people, including scientists, realize that we actually do not have any proof that consciousness is generated in the brain. More careful and discriminating materialistic philosophers and scientists refuse to wholeheartedly embrace the belief of the hardliners. They recognize that at least some aspects of our experience of the world cannot be explained as functions of the human brain. Following the ideas that Australian philosopher and cognitive scientist David Chalmers outlined in his 1996 book, The Conscious Mind, In Search of a Fundamental Theory, they differentiate between the hard and the easy problems of consciousness. The hard problem is to explain why we can have subjective experiences and how and why sensations acquire certain characteristics, such as colors, tastes, and smells. In other words, how something as tangible as a set of neurons can generate something as intangible as feelings, sensations, intuitions, and volitions. This contrasts with the easy problems of accounting for the ability to discriminate, integrate information, report mental states, focus attention, and so on. These are easy problems because all that it required for their solution is to specify a mechanism that can perform the function. The proposed solutions can be entirely consistent with the materialistic conception of natural phenomena. There are many scientists who have refused to accept that consciousness can be explained by brain mechanisms. Wilder Penfield, famous Canadian-American neurosurgeon who successfully treated hundreds of epileptic patients by excising the areas of their brains in which the seizures originated, amassed vast amounts of experimental data. While performing brain surgery on these patients using only local anesthesia, he studied their reactions to electric stimulation of various parts of their brain. He mapped the functions of various regions of the brain, such as the memory cortex of the temporal lobe and the motor cortex of the gyrus, lying in front of the central fissure of the brain, the homunculus. In the book, Mystery of the Mind, written toward the end of his life, he concluded that there was no good evidence that the brain alone can carry out the work that the mind does. Throughout my own scientific career, I, like the other scientists, have struggled to prove that the brain accounts for the mind. But now, perhaps, the time has come when we may profitably consider the evidence as it stands and ask the question, do brain mechanisms account for the mind? Can the mind be explained by what is now known about the brain? If not, which is the more reasonable of the two possible hypotheses, that man's being is based on one element or on two? I conclude that it is easier to rationalize man's being on the basis of two elements than on the basis of one. Anesthesiologist and brain researcher Stuart Hameroff initially suggested that the solution of the problem of consciousness might lie in the quantum processes in the cytoskeletal microtubules, nanometer-sized cylindrical structures found on the molecular and supramolecular level inside the brain cells. Hameroff's idea was based on his observation that some of the more puzzling aspects of consciousness resembled equally puzzling aspects of quantum properties. Even this conclusion, based on the sophisticated research of the brain, falls painfully short of bridging the formidable gap between matter and consciousness. In a video entitled Through the Wormhole that aired on the TV channel Science, Hameroff himself admitted it when he made this surprising statement. I believe that consciousness, or its immediate precursor proto-consciousness, has been in the universe all along, perhaps from the Big Bang. The origin of consciousness from matter is simply taken for granted as an obvious and self-evident fact, based on the metaphysical assumption of the primacy of matter in the universe. In fact, in the entire history of science, nobody has ever offered a plausible explanation for how consciousness could be generated by material processes, or even suggested a viable approach to the problem. Consider, for example, the book by Francis Crick, The Astonishing Hypothesis, The Scientific Search for the Soul. The book's jacket carried a very exciting promise. Nobel Prize-winning scientist explains consciousness. Crick's astonishing hypothesis was succinctly stated at the beginning of his book. You, your joys and your sorrows, your memories and your ambitions, your sense of personal identity and free will are in fact no more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. Who you are is nothing but a pack of neurons. At the beginning of the book, to simplify the problem of consciousness, Crick narrows his discussion by focusing on optical perception. He presents impressive experimental evidence showing that visual perception is associated with distinct physiological, biochemical, and electrical processes in the optical system from the retina through the optical tract to the suboccipital cortex. And there the discussion ends, as if the problem of consciousness has been satisfactorily solved. In reality, this is where the problem begins. What exactly is capable of transforming biochemical and electric processes in the brain into a conscious experience of a reasonable facsimile of the object we are observing in full color and project it into three-dimensional space? The formidable problem of the relationship between phenomena, things we perceive, Erscheinungen, and noumena, things as they truly are in themselves, Dinge an sich, was clearly articulated by 17th century German philosopher Immanuel Kant in the book Critique of Pure Reason. Scientists focus their efforts on the aspect of the problem where they find answers, the material processes in the brain. The much more mysterious problem, how physical processes in the brain generate consciousness, does not receive any attention because it is incomprehensible and cannot be solved. The attitude that Western science has adopted in regard to this issue resembles the famous Sufi story. On a dark night, Nasruddin, a satirical Sufi figure representing crazy wisdom, is crawling on his knees under a street lamp. His neighbor sees him and asks, "What are you doing? Are you looking for something?" Nasruddin answers that he is searching for a lost key, and the neighbor offers to help. After some time of unsuccessful joint effort, the neighbor becomes confused and feels the need for clarification. He says, "I don't see anything. Are you sure you lost it here?" Nasruddin shakes his head and points his finger to a dark area outside of the circle illuminated by the street lamp and replies, "No, not here, over there." The neighbor is puzzled and inquires further, "So why are we looking for it here and not over there?" Nasruddin explains, "Because it is light here and we can see. Over there it's dark and we would not have a chance." Similarly, materialistic scientists have systematically avoided the problem of the origin of consciousness because this riddle cannot be solved within the context of their conceptual framework. The idea that consciousness is a product of the brain is naturally not completely arbitrary. Its proponents usually refer to a vast body of very specific clinical and experimental evidence from neurology, neurosurgery, and psychiatry to support their position. The evidence for close correlations between the anatomy, neurophysiology, and biochemistry of the brain and states of consciousness is unquestionable and overwhelming. What is problematic is not the nature of the presented evidence, but the conclusions that are drawn from these observations. In formal logic, this type of fallacy is referred to as a non sequitur, an argument wherein the conclusion does not follow from the premises. While the experimental data clearly shows that consciousness is closely connected with the neurophysiological and biochemical processes in the brain, they have very little bearing on the nature and origin of consciousness. A simple analogy is the relationship between a TV set and the television program. The situation here is much clearer since it involves a system that is human-made and its operation is well known. The reception of the television program, the quality of the picture and the sound, depends on the proper functioning of the TV set and on the integrity of its components. Malfunctions of various parts coincide with distinct and specific changes in the quality of the program. Some of them lead to distortions of form, color, or sound, others to interference between the channels, and so on. Like the neurologist who uses changes in consciousness as a diagnostic tool, a television mechanic can infer from the nature of these anomalies which parts of the set and which specific components are malfunctioning. When the problem is identified, repairing or replacing these elements will correct the distortions. Since we know the basic principles of television technology, it is obvious to us that the set simply mediates the program and that it does not generate it. We would laugh at somebody who would try to scrutinize all the transistors, relays, and circuits of the TV set and analyze its wires in an attempt to figure out how it creates the programs. Even if we carried this misguided effort to a molecular, atomic, or subatomic level, we would have absolutely no clue as to why, at a particular time, a Mickey Mouse cartoon, a Star Trek sequence, or a Hollywood classic appear on the screen. The close correlation between the functioning of the TV set and the quality of the program does not necessarily mean that the entire secret of the program is in the set itself. Yet this is exactly the kind of conclusion that traditional materialistic science has drawn from comparable data about the brain and its relation to consciousness. Ample evidence suggests exactly the opposite, namely that under certain circumstances, consciousness can operate independently of its material substrate and can perform functions that reach far beyond the capacities of the brain. This is most clearly illustrated by the existence of out-of-body experiences, OBEs, which can occur spontaneously or in various facilitating situations, shamanic trances, psychedelic sessions, spiritual practice, hypnosis, experiential psychotherapy, and particularly in near-death experiences, NDEs. In all these situations, consciousness can separate from the body and maintain its sensory capacity while moving freely to various close and remote locations. In the Bardo Todol, the Tibetan Book of Death, the disembodied form of consciousness that develops at the time of death is called the Bardo body. Bardos are the intermediate states between incarnations. The consciousness can travel out of the physical body and get experiential access to any location in the world. The Bardo Todol mentions only two exceptions, Bodh Gaya and the mother's womb. The reference to Bodh Gaya, the place where Buddha reached enlightenment, suggests that reaching enlightenment terminates the journey through the Bardos. In Bardo Todol, the same happens when in the third Bardo, Tsidpa Bardo, we enter our future mother's womb. Veridical OBEs are particularly interesting because independent consensual verification confirms that the perception of the environment by disembodied consciousness is accurate. In near-death situations, veridical OBEs can occur even in people who are congenitally blind for organic reasons. Many other types of transpersonal phenomena can also mediate accurate information about various aspects of the universe that had not been previously received and recorded in the brain. Other people, animals, plants, historical events, and archetypal figures and realms. In 2016, the world's foremost systems theorist and philosopher of Hungarian origin, Ervin Laszlo, published a book entitled What is Reality? The New Map of Cosmos, Consciousness, and Existence. Addressing the problem of the nature and origin of consciousness, he described the answers to this question as they developed historically and subjected them to logical analysis in the light of existing clinical and experimental evidence. He showed how the concept of consciousness shifted from that of a local to a non-local and then to a cosmic phenomenon. In the mainstream materialistic worldview, consciousness is generated in and confined to the human brain. According to this theory, there is nothing mysterious about the presence of consciousness in human experience. The stream of experience we call consciousness is a byproduct of the neurophysiological processes in the brain. This idea was expressed in the most blatant way in a statement by the French physician and materialistic philosopher of the Enlightenment, Julien Aufray de Lemaître, best known for his work L'Homme Machine, Man as a Machine. He said, "There is nothing special about consciousness. The brain secretes consciousness like the kidney excretes urine." Laszlo called this understanding of consciousness the turbine theory. The stream of consciousness is generated by the living brain, much as a stream of electrons is generated by a working turbine. As long as the turbine functions, it generates a stream of electrons, electricity. As long as the brain functions, it generates a stream of sensations, consciousness. When they shut down, the streams they generate vanish. Consciousness no more exists in a dead brain than electric charge exists in a stopped or destroyed turbine. Laszlo pointed out some serious problems that the turbine theory has encountered. Thanatological research has brought overwhelming evidence that consciousness does not cease to operate when the brain activity stops. There exist many reports about NDEs of individuals in a state of clinical death, with a flat cardiogram, ECG, or even electroencephalogram, EEG. This phenomenon has been supported by thousands of clinical observations and proven beyond any reasonable doubt. Laszlo also refers to other interesting evidence that remains controversial. There are indications that conscious experience persists in some form, not just during the temporary cessation of brain function, but also in its permanent absence, when the subject is fully and irreversibly dead. The problems with the turbine model could be overcome if we compare this to a networked computer. A computer with memory and a link to other computers and information systems. Here, the information entered in a computer is identified by a particular code and can be recalled from the system with that code. When recalled, it will appear precisely as entered in the computer, displayed on another device. This information is then present in a universally accessible data system, such as the cloud. This system stores and integrates all items of information, regardless of their origin, and allows their recall. This type of integral memory function could account for transpersonal psychiatrists' observations that in holotropic states, consciousness can expand to retrieve information from almost anything in space and time, as we will see in a later section of this book. It could also explain the experiences of individuals who are biologically related or have strong emotional bonds. Such people, like mothers and children, twins, and lovers, seem to be tuned into each other's consciousness. Mediums also seem able to tune into the consciousness of the person they contact. The networked computer theory of consciousness suggests that the traces of the consciousness present in the brain are also present beyond the brain. According to this model, consciousness is not a personal and local phenomenon, but a transpersonal and non-local one. Irvin Laszlo described such a natural memory field in his book, The Creative Cosmos, Towards a Unified Science of Matter, Life, and Mind, and called it a psi field. In his later work, he changed this name to Akashic field. This concept of a sub-quantum field containing a holographic record of everything that happens in the universe was the first scientific theory to address the baffling problems encountered in the research of holotropic states. How was it possible to experience convincing time travel to ancient Egypt, Japan during the time of the samurais, Paris during the French Revolution, or authentic identification with other people and animals? As the title of his more recent book, Science in the Akashic Field, suggests, Irvin Laszlo has been able to formulate not only a unifying conceptual framework for a number of scientific disciplines, but also to create a bridge that connects the best of hard science quite explicitly to the great Eastern spiritual philosophies and to transpersonal psychology. A computer permanently linked with a universal information system that saves the uploaded information and integrates it into an overall information system adequately models consciousness not as a personal and local phenomenon, but a transpersonal and non-local one. Traces of consciousness present in the brain are also present beyond the brain. However, Laszlo pointed out that even the networked computer theory of consciousness does not explain the full extent of the evidence from holotropic states. It seems that in some instances, the units of consciousness that persist beyond the brain are not mere traces or copies of the elements that were experienced in the everyday state of consciousness. They seem to be autonomous units of living consciousness. Sometimes an individual does not just recall the experience of a deceased person, but enters into communication with it. An example of this phenomenon is the welcoming committee experienced by people in near-death situations. Here, the subject encounters deceased relatives and friends who appear to be intelligent beings, able to provide information and answer questions. C.G. Jung had a similar experience with his spirit guide Philemon, who kept appearing to him during his spiritual emergency, and was capable of answering questions to which Jung himself did not know the answers. Jung actually credited Philemon as the source of significant aspects of his psychology. This is Jung's description of his interactions with Philemon in his own words. "Philemon and other figures of my fantasies brought home to me the crucial insight that there are things in the psyche which I do not produce, but which produce themselves and have their own life. Philemon represented a force which was not myself. In my fantasies, I held conversations with him, and he said things which I had not consciously thought." Jung also had a dramatic experience of spirits visiting his house, at which time he channeled a text that came from the Alexandrian Gnostic philosopher Basilides. This text, one of the most remarkable works Jung wrote, was published with the title Septem Sermonis ad Mortuos, Seven Sermons for the Dead. Today, it is seen as a summary revelation of the Red Book. During one of my visits to Florence, I had the chance to spend a day with Roberto Assagioli several months before his death. He told me that he had channeled important ideas for his psychotherapeutic system, known as psychosynthesis, from a spirit guide who called himself the Tibetan. It was allegedly the same entity from whom Alice Bailey received the metaphysical teachings that she described in a series of her books. Quasi-experimental evidence for the survival of consciousness after death can be found in the literature on spiritism and mental or trance mediumship. Reports about spiritistic seances abounded in the 19th and beginning of the 20th century. Although some of the professional mediums, including the famous Eusapia Palladino, were occasionally caught cheating, others, such as Mrs. Piper, Mrs. Leonard, and Mrs. Verall, withstood all the tests and gained the high esteem of careful and reputable researchers. The best mediums were able to accurately reproduce the deceased's voice, speech patterns, gestures, mannerisms, and other characteristic features. On occasion, the information received by the medium was unknown to any of the people present, or even to anyone living at all. Uninvited drop-in entities suddenly intruded into the seances, and in some cases their identities were later confirmed. In other instances, relevant messages were received in proxy sittings, where a distant and uninformed party has sought information in lieu of a close relative or friend of the deceased. In cases of cross-correspondence, bits and pieces of a comprehensive message were conveyed through several mediums. Participants in some of these seances were Nobel Prize-winning scientists. There is no other area in which the testimonies of thinkers of such high caliber have been so easily dismissed. In his paper entitled Xenoglossy, Verification of the Speech of an Unlearned Language, William Coutts presented the results of his analysis of a 90-year-old abandoned British case of mediumship involving foreign speech. The analysis showed that the examples of the extensive phonetic transcription, 5,000 phrases over 30 years, are genuine late Egyptian, a language that has been dead for 1,600 years. This result provides a confirmed example of the alleged phenomenon of xenoglossy, the speaking of a real foreign language by a person who never learned it. This case has important implications in psychology, Egyptology, linguistics, and the use of intuitive methods for obtaining detailed and accurate information of any kind. It offers especially what is perhaps the best evidence yet, though not a full proof, for the continuation of human consciousness beyond bodily death, the classic survival problem. In our Esalen month-long workshops, we repeatedly had the opportunity to witness the remarkable abilities of the American psychic Anne Armstrong. A good example was a reading that Anne did for a German participant about her deceased father. After giving this woman highly relevant and accurate information about her father, Anne suddenly announced that she was getting a word that she did not understand. It happened to be a German term of endearment for little children that this woman's father used for her in her childhood. Anne was surprised by the intensity with which this word was entering her consciousness. She had no idea what it meant, since she did not speak any German. In another Esalen month-long workshop entitled Energy, Physical, Emotional, and Psychic, we had an extraordinary experience which involved Brazilian spiritist and psychologist Luiz Gasparetto. Luiz had the reputation of being able to channel the spirits of famous deceased painters and paint in their style. He was a member of the Christian Spiritist Church and was inspired by 19th-century French educator and physician Alan Kardec's writing in The Spirit's Book and The Medium's Book.